Welcome to episode 22 of Indestructible, Indestructible Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. If you like the content of this podcast, you may want to consider supporting us on Patreon. All of our patrons are now receiving a small selection of references to articles, podcasts, and books which deal with some of the key topics discussed in each episode. Another way you can support us is by simply sharing this episode and letting your friends know about this podcast. You will find us on Spotify under the name Alborada, which is spelled A-L-B-O-R-A-D-A, and on Twitter and Facebook under Indestructible Podcasts. On Instagram, you will find us under the title Indestructible Pod. For those of you who are interested in Latin America, the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico would have come up on your radar at some point. Whether it is reggaeton artists like Daddy Yankee or Bad Bunny, who constantly make references to the Puerto Rican nationality, or the National Puerto Rican Day Parade that takes place every year in New York City, home to one of the largest Puerto Rican diaspora communities, the island of Puerto Rico, with just over 3 million inhabitants, is a point of reference in popular culture, both in the United States and throughout Latin America. But move beyond these popular images, and what we find is an island that was colonized by the United States in 1898 after it defeated Spain in the Spanish-American War earlier that year. Despite the fact that Puerto Ricans have been U.S. citizens since 1917 and can move freely between the island and the mainland, Puerto Ricans are disenfranchised at the national level as they do not get to vote for the U.S. president or vice president. While during six previous referendums between 1967 through to 2022, the vote for independence received little support. Following the devastating aftermath of Hurricane Maria in 2017, Puerto Ricans were reminded to think about their relationship with the United States as the administration of Donald Trump withheld roughly $20 billion in hurricane relief for the island. In order to shed some light on Puerto Rican history, in this episode, I speak to Margaret M. Power, who is Professor Emerita of History at the Illinois Institute of Technology in the U.S. She's the author of numerous books, including Right-Wing Women in Chile, Feminine Power and the Struggle Against the Allende, 1964 to 1973, and Hope in Hard Times, Norvelt and the Struggle for Community During the Great Depression, which was co-written with Timothy Kelly and Michael Carey. In her latest book, Solidarity Across the Americas, the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party and Anti-Imperialism is published by the University of North Carolina Press and forms the basis of this interview. I now leave you with Margaret M. Power. In the introduction of your book, Solidarity Across the Americas, the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party and Anti-Imperialism, you state that your personal connection to the struggle of Puerto Rican independence dates back to 1975, when you heard about the five nationalist political prisoners who had been imprisoned in the United States since the 1950s. That's a direct quote from your book. Who were these political prisoners, and why did their cause move you towards activism to support their release?
The five nationalist political prisoners were members of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, which was a pro-independence organization. And they were arrested in the United States in two separate incidents. They had been based in the Nationalist Party in New York City. And in 1950, the Nationalist Party in Puerto Rico, realizing that the United States was engineering, in conjunction with Puerto Ricans, was engineering a transformation in the visible status of Puerto Rico from an outright colony to what it's now remains a free associated state or a commonwealth, which is meaningless. And they wanted to call world attention to the fact that Puerto Rico was a U.S. colony, and there were Puerto Ricans who opposed U.S. colonialism, and they particularly timed it to coincide with the meeting of the Organization of American States in Caracas, Venezuela. So four of the Puerto Rican nationalists from New York City bought one-way tickets, went to New York City, entered into the visitors gallery of the U.S. Congress, and basically opened fire. Lolita Lebron, who led the attack, actually aimed at the cupola, at the ceiling, unfurled the Puerto Rican flag, and yelled, "Viva Puerto Rico Libre!" The other three, who were men, shot down at the base, at the congressman, wounding five. Nobody was killed. They were all subsequently arrested, tried of various charges, but the substantial one was seditious conspiracy. That's those four people. And then that was in 1954. I completely mixed up the dates. I'm really sorry. That was in 1954, but in 1950, there was an uprising in Puerto Rico. And two other members of the Nationalist Party in New York City wanted to call world attention again. The aim of the Nationalist Party was to call global attention to their situation in Puerto Rico. So in order to point out the fact that there was not a civil war going on in Puerto Rico, which is how the U.S. media portrayed it, they wanted to say, no, we are fighting against U.S. colonialism. So that's why the uprising was staged, and that's why two Puerto Ricans from New York City then traveled again to Washington, D.C. Their goal at that time was to assassinate President Harry Truman. They went to the house he was staying in, opened fire. One of them was killed, Griselio Torresola, and they in turn killed a D.C. police officer. The other one, Oscar Collazo, was seriously wounded and imprisoned. So the five nationalists were Oscar Collazo from the 1950s and the four others from 1954. Mm-hmm. What moved me about it was, I should just say, I grew up as a very conservative Republican in Southwest Pennsylvania, and which may be of in particular interest, my father was Australian. I'm actually half Australian. You, of course, don't hear it in my accent at all. So when I was 15, my father had died. My mother took the family to Australia. I lived in Australia for 6 months, and then I was in this completely different world. And that opened my mind to a lot of different ideas and a lot of different ways of looking at the world. So at that point, I came back to the United States and I began to question a lot about the United States. And then when I heard that Puerto Rico was a colony, I thought, my country has a colony? It was complete news to me. Then I learned that these people had actually been fighting for the independence of their nation. And I learned about the terrible treatment that they had received within prison, and that they had been in prison for, at that point, roughly 20 years, something, roughly 20 years. And I thought, this is not fair. This is not right. So I was basically guided by the idea that it's wrong for a country, in this case, my country, to hold another people colonized or imprisoned, really, and that I needed to do something about it. Then I learned about the five people, and I was very moved by them.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back in history to the era of the Spanish Empire, I found it interesting that you noted that the Creole elite did not feel the need to rise up against Spanish colonial rule as their counterparts throughout Latin America did in the early part of the 1800s. Mm. Now, for our audience, could you cover some of this history briefly, as well as the importance of the Spanish-American War of 1898?
Yes. So these are two distinct phases. So I'll start with the first. Whereas most of Spanish America rose up and achieved its independence in the early 1900s, basically by 1824, several things happened that dampened the possibility for Puerto Rico and in addition Cuba. And one of the central features was the Haitian Revolution. What the Haitian Revolution, which was incredibly had an amazing impact throughout the Americas in its entirety. Basically, what it did is it combined the struggle for independence from France with the struggle to end slavery. Both Cuba and Puerto Rico were slave-based societies. So when slave owners, French slave owners, fled Haiti, they went to Cuba, they went to Puerto Rico, and every place they went, they brought with them these horrible tales about, oh, this is what happens if you fight for independence. The slaves will rise up, they will kill you, they will murder you, they will rape you, they will burn your property. So the slave owners, the Creole elite in both countries said, in that case, we have to cling to the security of the Spanish Empire. We don't want to basically endanger our position within society. And speaking specifically about Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico was at that time a bit more of a backwater of the Spanish Empire. It did not have the developed economy. It didn't have this very large population. There was not a kind of opposition or the kind of movement in Puerto Rico. It didn't occur really up until 1868, when Puerto Ricans had joined with Cubans as the last two remaining Spanish colonies, to join together to fight for independence. That was a failure. In Puerto Rico, the uprising, the Grito de Lares, or the Cry of Lares, and Lares is a small town in the mountainous interior of Puerto Rico, and it has been a seat of the independence movement. Earlier, I mentioned Lolita Lebron, who led the attack on the U.S. Congress in 1954. She was from Lares, and I think she grew up with, as did many people, grew up with this idea of we're a colony, we should support in independence. In any case, the movement in Puerto Rico for independence then was postponed in a certain sense until 1898. But even in 1898, there was not the kind of movement in fighting for independence that, say, occurred in Cuba. Many Puerto Ricans believed in the myth of the United States as a nation that represents freedom, as a nation that represents liberty. And because they had been so repressed under Spain, they thought, well, under the United States, things will be so much better. And in fact, they weren't. Although initially, I think it's the way people sort of try to convince themselves, okay, they're bad, but they will get better. They will get better, because the alternative is kind of scary. And so I think many people thought, well, yes, that the United, maybe the beginning is a little rough, but after a while, things will smooth out and we will have our independence and we will have at least respect. And that didn't happen.
And the Spanish American War of 1898, I mean, really an excuse for the United States to intervene colonize Puerto Rico and Cuba. I mean, do we know, for example, what happened on the main? Was that ever, because the Spanish were blamed for the sinking of that battleship, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Both Cubans and Puerto Ricans were genuinely fighting for independence. The U.S. sent in the warship, the USS Maine. It exploded. I cannot say there is consensus, but I think they're about exactly what happened. But I think the most popularly and scholarly received opinion is that a boiler blew up. That it was not. It was not Spain. No, okay. Nor was it that the United States actually planned it, but that blew up. But of course, there are people on both sides that say, "No, no, it was Spain. No, no, it was the United States." But in any case, it was. I don't think almost anybody thinks it was Spain that did it, which would, of course, be nonsensical that they would, because why would they want to antagonize the United States and therefore have the United States come into the war? Instead, it's true that the United States then seized upon it and said, aha, they have attacked us. It's very similar to the Gulf of Tonkin, say, in Vietnam, or the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Correct.
Aha, they've attacked us. Therefore, we must attack them. And so I think what happened is then that the United States fully engaged in the war in Cuba, actually, and in the Philippines and in Puerto Rico, claiming to come in to fight for the liberation of these people and these places, but in fact coming in to establish U.S. control over these what had formerly been Spanish colonies and were now under U.S. control. So it was pivotal because for many people throughout Latin America, they saw it as an act of overt intervention, imperialist aggression.
Now, in your book, you talk about U.S. efforts to Americanize Puerto Rico in the early part of the 20th century. Could you comment a little on these efforts and, I guess, the current diplomatic status of the island and its inhabitants? What voting rights, for example, do Puerto Ricans have in U.S. elections?
Yes, the United States at that point was basically, I think of it as very much as a Jim Crow nation, meaning a lot of the attitudes of Southern slave owners, Southern white supremacists permeated the entire nation to the degree that if you were not white, and not only white of European extraction, but Protestant, Anglo-Saxon or German extraction, then you were considered inferior. So the whole debate within the U.S. Congress is, what do we do with these people? They're obviously inferior because they're not white. They were the products of Spain, but they were mixed race, so they weren't Spanish. And they just really are not ready to be U.S. citizens. What we can do is civilize them. And in the United States popular mind is and also in the official mind, there was a conflation of civilized and Americanized. And therefore, the United States began a massive effort to, for example, rewrite the educational system so that Puerto Ricans were taught in English. And I think if you attempt to destroy a people's language, it's not just, oh, I've learned another language. It's also in this case, and in many cases, the idea that we're going to destroy your language, therefore destroy in this large sense your identity and your culture and impose ours and make it basically the language and therefore hopefully the way you see the world, since language is so critical to how we understand the reality around us. And I think everybody who speaks more than one language, I think, can understand this very clearly, that you, in a way, you're saying the same thing, but not always. And I notice when I speak Spanish, for example, I feel different. I think a little different. My emotions are different. And I think that's the exact same goal that the United States had in mind. They also wanted to impose U.S. religion. So they wanted to get rid of Catholicism. Protestant missionaries were sent in. Protestant missionaries were sent in not only to set up Protestant churches, but also to have Protestant schools. Once again, enforcing this idea that the Protestant religion is superior. Catholicism is a very backward religion. Spain is a backward language, and therefore we've got to try and bring them up to U.S. standards. And this was just part of it. And you go the whole way down the line, the administration, everything, the governors, the local rulers in Puerto Rico up until 1948, every single one of them was appointed by the United States. And up until the 1846, not a single one of them, for example, spoke Spanish. That, why would they? They're in a U.S. colony. Puerto Ricans were granted citizenship in 1917. That was a decision made not in Puerto Rico, but made in Washington. And it's Interesting. Most people think, okay, I'm a citizen. If you're a citizen in port of a Puerto Rican citizen in Puerto Rico, yes, you can immigrate to the United States. But if you live in Puerto Rico, you cannot vote for the president, you cannot vote for the senator, you cannot vote for a congressperson, meaning you're a citizen. Again, it's like it's this anomalous situation. You are a citizen, but you can't vote for the federal government. And right now, there is this huge debate going on within the United States about, so should Puerto Rico become a state? And the Democratic Party or sectors of the Democratic Party are pushing statehood for Puerto Rico because they believe that if Puerto Rico came in, they would get two senators, Democratic, and Democratic Congress people. So they want Puerto Rico to come in, which is, again, it's a colonial attitude that Puerto Ricans don't exist for the sake of Puerto Ricans. They exist for how they will benefit, in this case, the Democratic Party. The Republican Party does not want Puerto Rico to become a state for fairly obvious reasons, in that that means that the Democratic Party will gain all these seats. However, there is also this debate going on because maybe it's always not so clear, cut and dry, that that's exactly what will happen. And also, Republican Party by and large, which in my mind is has become and increasingly becoming a party of white racism in the United States. They don't want Puerto Ricans. So to this day, Puerto Ricans can immigrate to the United States. They don't have visa problems. That's not an issue, but they don't have voting rights.
Now, on the 17th of September, 1922, the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, the PNPR, was born with a primary objective to work towards Puerto Rico's independence. In 1930, Pedro Albizu Campos became its president and welcomed women into the party. In one of his speeches, which you quote, he said, quote, "Women are the physical and moral mothers of the nation. When men forget their patriotic duty and play the game of illegitimate politics, then it is the role of women to call on them to fulfill their duty. Women need to remind their husbands and brothers to carry out their debt of honor." Take us through these years, the role of women within the PNPR, and why the PNPR provoked your interest to write a book about them, in contrast to, say, the other political parties on the island.
I'm going to take the last part of the question first and then go back. I wanted to write about a book about Puerto Rico because I realized very few people in this country understood anything or very much about Puerto Rico. It's again one of those things, where on the map is it? It's a colony. What does that mean? What those kind of things, which actually I found through my teaching that a lot of my students didn't know that, and then in conversation with other people. So I thought, I want to write a book about Puerto Rico. At first, I actually was going to write a book about Puerto Rican women and the Nationalist Party and gender issues. But then I decided I wanted instead to look at the Nationalist Party in a much more broader, actually hemispheric context. And a little possible segue. I had originally done my doctoral dissertation on right-wing women in Chile, the women who opposed Allende and supported the Salvador Allende and supported the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. And in doing so, I came across a document that Salvador Allende, the future president of Chile, gave after Pedro Albizu Campos died in 1965, in which he eulogized Salvador Allende and called for Puerto Rican independence. So I thought, if Salvador Allende in Chile, which is a bit far from Puerto Rico, is saying this and thinking about these things, I wonder if other Latin American countries are. So that prompted me to actually do research and find out what other Latin was being said or thought or done in other Latin American countries. So then I decided basically I wanted to write a book in which the protagonists were Puerto Ricans who supported independence. So obviously for me, that became the Nationalist Party, because I thought, how better to understand colonialism than through the eyes and the words and the lives of those who are fighting against it. And because, as we started out the interview, I had supported the release of the Puerto Rican nationalist political prisoners, I actually felt I knew about them, and I had some background in them, and in them and in the Nationalist Party. So all of those factors, and because I work very closely with the Puerto Rican community here in Chicago, and that therefore provided me contacts with people in the Nationalist Party, the surviving members of the Nationalist Party when I first began the research. The good thing about taking a long time meant that I started earlier, and some of the Nationalist Party's members were still alive, which basically, as I think I say in the book, one, possibly two of them are still alive today, and that's all. Maybe there are others that I'm not aware of. Okay, so that's why I wrote the book, and
the role of women within
the
role
party. Of women, exactly. I was looking at the questions you sent me because I thought, wait, I should have done the first one first. In any case, in the initial, let's say, 8 years of the party, women were virtually absent. I think they attended events, they possibly accompanied their husbands, fathers, brothers, but they weren't spokes, they didn't speak, they really didn't do much within the party. Pedro Albizu Campos, once he was elected president in 1930, he basically understood two things. First of all, that in order for Puerto Rico to succeed, we need the involvement of every single person who supports independence. So in a sense, he overcame the gendered idea of how politics were done in Puerto Rico, as in much of the world, which is that the politics is something men do, women have more of a domestic role in life. He jumped over that sort of gendered blinding barrier and said we need to have women involved. But he also involved women because he had a very high respect for their capabilities and their responsibilities. And although some people, and that quote, for example, would indicate that he saw women in a particularly gendered fashion, therefore as mothers or as women who were more moral and therefore somewhat morally superior to men, more reliable, there is some truth to that. But he also saw women in their full capacity. But in any case, what he did is that he pushed all women to get involved in the party. However, that coincided with the fact that many women wanted to be members of the party and wanted to play an active role. So this was not just, had the leadership of the Nationalist Party simply said, we want to get more women involved, it would not have been a success had women themselves not wanted to be involved. And in fact, women in the 1930s were members of different women's organizations within the party. By the 1950s, women played a much more prominent role in that. In the 1950 uprising I mentioned earlier, one woman, Blanca Canales, actually led the revolt in Jayuya, which is another one of the towns in the interior. And as I said before, Lolita Lebron led the attack. She was appointed the commander of the attack by Albizu himself. So I think this is not to say every single man within the Nationalist Party had these ideas that, yes, women should be military commanders. Yes, women should define themselves as political actors first and foremost, which is what a number of the women in the Nationalist Party did. Nor is it to say that all the women in the Nationalist Party had different ideas, sort of non-traditional ideas about gender. many combined both ideas. But I think what we do see within the Nationalist Party is this sense that women have an important contribution to make, and that the nation cannot come into being without their active contribution.
I mean, you cover a lot about the party in the 1930s, but by the 1940s, a pro-US party, the Partido Popular Democrático, obtained an overwhelming amount of a number of seats in the legislature, while in 1948 it passed the Ley de Mordaza, the gag law, which attempted to suppress the Nationalist Party and similar opposition. In 1950, two nationalists attempted to assassinate President Harry S. Truman, as you mentioned before, while in another incident, again, you mentioned in the House of Representatives, PNPR members shot and wounded five congressmen. For our audience, could you comment on these years and your research on the PNPR and their eventual political demise?
Yes. Going briefly back to the 30s was the time of the Depression. And in Puerto Rico, it was felt particularly acutely. Unemployment was very high. Food was very expensive because so much of the agriculture had been turned over to production of sugarcane for export to the United States. And the United States had passed a law that no goods came into Puerto Rico unless they were carried on U.S. ships, which meant that they were always going to be more expensive. As a result, Puerto Ricans were suffering, and the idea of independence and the appeal of the Nationalist Party rose. At that point, the United States said, we've got to step up our repression against the PNPR, the Nationalist Party, and that policy continued throughout the 1930s into the 1940s. And the gag law, which you mentioned, was modeled after a law in the United States, an anti-communist law. This was the beginning of the McCarthy period, applied to Puerto Ricans. It basically said anybody who supports independence basically can be arrested, which is, of course, an outright violation of freedom of speech. The Nationalist Party then said, okay, in a sense, we have got to respond. That was going on the Nationalist Party side. On the U.S. side, the United States came out of World War II and said, we are basically, the Cold War begins, we've got to portray ourselves as a nation that is fighting for liberation, for anti-colonialism, for freedom around the world. So we've got to change the status of Puerto Rico, or the visible status of Puerto Rico. They worked very closely with the Popular Democratic Party and its leader, Luis Muñoz Marin. And his policy was, we will not talk about the status of Puerto Rico. What we will talk about is the living standards of Puerto Rican people. And under me, you will live much better. And I think that had a tremendous amount of appeal to people, because after, let's say, by this time, about 50 years of U.S. rule, the idea was, okay, we want things to be better. Status may not be the key issue. Me having enough to eat and my family have enough to eat is. So the two coalesced. On the one hand, we have the surge of support for the Puerto Rican, the Popular Democratic Party, and massive repression against the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, such that in the 1930s, the entire leadership, or the top leadership of the Nationalist Party, was sent into exile in Atlanta. They were taken away from Puerto Rico. Puerto Ricans recounted to me that they were so terrified by the repression that they burned anything that they had related to the Nationalist Party. The U.S. government set up massive infiltration and informants throughout Puerto Rico, which came out much later that files were kept on Puerto Ricans who possibly spoke about or were members of the Nationalist Party. So I think there was this tremendous level of fear that permeated the island. And then I think other people thought violence is not the way to go. And so we will go with with a safer model, and
Mm-hmm.
they didn't want to pursue independence through violent means.
And finally, and very quickly, where do you see the aspirations of pro-independence Puerto Ricans heading into the future? Could you tell us maybe a little bit about the past referendums that the islands had and their results?
The referendum is set up on the basis that the Puerto Ricans can vote on the status. However, the United States Congress has absolutely no obligation to respect the outcome of the vote. So, if Puerto Ricans would vote for independence, the U.S. Congress would then determine whether or not they wanted to support it. So, there has been an increasing dissatisfaction and alienation from the whole issue of the plebiscites, whereas, say, in the most recent one, statehood won, but that's because the majority, there was a much larger vote of abstention or people that basically didn't vote on the ballot. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, after Hurricane Maria devastated the island in 2017, a lot of people on the one hand thought, well, if we were a state, we'd get better treatment. Many people thought, look how they treat us. We've got to rely on ourselves. So there has been a whole move in Puerto Rico to build up their own agricultural system using organic methods to try and rebuild the economy in Puerto Rican hands, so that Puerto Ricans could have the possibility of sustaining themselves independent. So there's not a real clear-cut course, and I think people are trying to think independently. What would independence mean, since the majority of Puerto Ricans live in the United States, and people don't want to sort of break, meaning that I can't travel to the United States, I lose contact with my family, nor do they want to lose the pensions that they have gotten or the Social Security benefits. So there's not a clear strategy at this point. The independence movement is weak and divided, but I think people are trying to be creative and figure out, so if we were independent, how would that work?
Margaret M. Power, Professor Emerita of History at Illinois Institute of Technology, thank you for speaking to us at Indestructible, Indestructible at Alborada.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. You have had really great questions. They've been very challenging, so I appreciate that.
And thank you for the copy of your book. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I would recommend it to our audience to pick up. So thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you.
As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible. Once again, I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon, which you can do for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any comments on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on Alborada's website. We'll be back soon with episode 23, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.